Hello, everyone. Today's Wednesday, January 10th, and we're going to start the Senate Interim Committee on Workforce. And we are going to skip ahead and go right to some work sessions to introduce committee legislative concepts. I apologize in advance. I'm a little under the weather. So I'm going to read here from our script to make certain that I don't miss anything. So I'm going to open a work session for the purpose of introducing committee measures. The following three LCs will be introduced. Number one, we have LC 34, allows a facility providing therapy or counseling that incorporates activities utilizing a non-clinical setting to be established in an area zoned for exclusive farm use if certain conditions are met. LC 48 requires the Department of Human Services to establish minimum training standards and provide training for home care workers and personal support workers. It also directs DHS and the Home Care Commission to maximize federal funding available to pay for training. And then thirdly, LC 218 prescribes the method for calculating weekly wage for workers in order to determine benefits payable for temporary total disability under workers' compensation law. A little note on the LC 218. The LC 218 draft currently on OLUS will not be the final. The advocates are seeking rather substantive changes, but this bill is intended to fix an issue that has arisen in how time loss benefits are calculated. The bill further clarifies that the division should draft rules for insurers that it uses the most recent rate of pay with an average of hours looking back at previous 52 weeks in the current job for workers that have seen a change in rate of pay. The current calculation rule averages wages for the previous 52 weeks in the current job, which often can result in a lower time loss calculation. For every dollar increase in wages, depending on the time of injury, a worker could see up to $26 less in their time loss payment as a result of the change if they work a 40-hour work week. As a reminder, a vote to introduce a measure does not designate support for the substance of the measure. It serves only to allow the proposal to be introduced. So with that being said, I was hoping that Senator Gelser would be here by now, but she is not. So I think we'll, can we go ahead, or do we need to wait for her? Or
no,
we can please go ahead, and she can vote later, I guess. So Senator Knope, can you?
Yeah, Chair Taylor, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 34, dated 1-8-18, LC 48, dated 1-10-18, and LC 218, dated 1-5-18.
Senator Knope moves the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 34, dated 1-8-18, LC 48, dated 1-10-18, LC 218, dated 1-5-18. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, the measures are introduced as committee bills. And then we'll go ahead and close the work session. So thank you, everybody. We did that because we had some folks that just came here for that piece, and so we wanted to get that out of the way. So now we're going to move to the meat of the hearing, shall we say, and we're going to open an informational meeting on the Public Employees Retirement System Unfunded Actuarial Liability, or UAL, paydown. Last session, the Senate Workforce Committee took a close look at PERS and several proposals to ensure its financial stability. Governor Brown appointed a task force to identify options to generate additional funding to reduce the PERS UAL by up to $5 billion over the next 5 years. On November 1, 2017, the task force submitted its report to the governor. Today, we'll hear about the task force findings and recommendations. So on that, I'll call Alana Pirtle-Ginney from the Governor's Labor and Workforce Policy, the Governor's Labor and Workforce Policy Advisor, and Corey Streisinger, member of the Governor's PERS UAL Task Force. And I'm just going to go ahead and make note, if people are looking on OLUS and everybody here, we have this nice task force final report and the UAL pay down. So we have the printed copies, but folks should have that. We're going to have the slideshow as well. So great. Who's going to start?
I'll do a brief introduction.
Okay, great.
Thank you, Chair Taylor, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ilana Pirtle-Ginney. I am the governor's labor and workforce policy advisor. Chair Taylor, I appreciate your introduction to the work of the task force. Coming out of the great work that your committee did last session, the governor took a hard look at where the cost drivers lie within the PERS system and what we could do in a pretty short period of time to try to address some of the increasing costs that public employers in the state are facing, and really came to the conclusion that what we needed to do in the immediate term was address the UAL that's driving a lot of those costs. What I'd like to do today is allow Corey Streisinger to take some time to go over the work of the task force and update you all on what occurred over the six-month period that the task force met, and then I'll lead into a conversation about the bill coming out of their work that the governor is bringing to you in February.
Okay.
Chair Taylor, members of the committee, my name is Corey Streisinger, and I did serve as a member of the governor's task force on the PERS unfunded actuarial liability. We met for several months, starting in about August, and specifically the governor asked us to identify $5 billion that could be used to pay down the liability over approximately 5 years. There were a few issues that the governor took off the table in giving us our charge. For example, don't sell any state parks. We were asked not to look at major tax reform issues. And we were also asked not to look at the PERS system and the benefit structure specifically, because that work we understood is going on elsewhere. So we were asked to look at funding options that for paying down the UAL specifically. And aside from those few carve-outs, we were given a broad scope and told we could pretty much look at anything that we wanted to. The task force was 7 members, 4 executives from the private sector, 3 with experience in the public sector at different levels. As some of you know, I'm one of those with experience in the public sector as a prior director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and before that, general counsel at the Port of Portland. Although we were not subject to the public meetings law, nevertheless, most of our meetings were held in public, most of our discussions took place in public, and we also had a process for accepting public comment and input. Early in the task force process, we came up with some basic principles for our work. First, we decided that we were not going to make specific recommendations, but rather come up with a list of options. And what I mean by that is we did not attempt to come up with a list that every member of the task force affirmatively would support. We wanted to come up with a list of options that we felt were not unreasonable for policymakers such as yourselves to consider. The flip side of that is we did feel it was our charge not to put forward ideas that we actually thought were unreasonable public policy or were not feasible or would not actually produce long-range assets for the UAL. Just to give you an example, one of the ideas that came up was the possibility of selling and leasing back public buildings, and we did not include that in our list of options because our analysis showed that although it would produce cash in the short run, it would increase expenses in the long run. So that's the type of example of an idea that we did not feel passed our screen. We decided it was not our job to evaluate the political feasibility of the options we came forward with, that we would, again, leave that to the governor and to this body. And finally, due to our limited time, we were not able to do a full analysis of each of the concepts that we considered. We included those that we believed, based on the work that we had done, were feasible and were worth further analysis, and we attempted to identify issues and areas where we thought our further analysis would in fact be needed. Because PERS affects government employers at all levels, we looked for options at all levels, cities and counties, special districts and school districts, the university system, the public corporations, and, of course, state government. Each task force member was asked to take on some specific assignments related to specific units of government, to go explore options, to talk to people who were particularly knowledgeable in those areas, and then brought concepts back to the full task force. Concept papers were prepared, which you will find in the report in the appendices, which provide some of the detail of what we came up with. And in each instance, we tried to identify the financial potential of the option as well as key policy considerations, although in some areas, as you will see, we were not able to identify a dollar figure that we felt comfortable putting forward. The sum total of what we did come up with that we were able to put rough numbers to did, in fact, total in the $4 to $6 billion range, meeting the governor's request. Although there may be some overlap between them, we certainly wouldn't guarantee what the number would be if you were to implement some or all of those measures. Because there is such a wide range of variation among local governments, we concluded that the best approach for local governments, rather than trying to come up with a prescriptive list applicable to everybody, would be to identify a range of local government opportunities, to ask each local government to come up with its own plan, making use of those opportunities as appropriate, and then to set up a matching fund that would be an incentive for local governments to come up with funds to pay down their own portion of the unfunded actuarial liability with a potential add-on from a state fund. And then at the state level, we identified a number of more concrete options that could be used to generate funds, first of all, to set up that matching fund, and secondly, to pay into the unfunded actuarial liability directly. I'm not going to go through each of the options in the report, but just in very broad terms, we looked for windfall revenue, we looked for other one-time or unexpected or variable types of revenue sources that could potentially be used for the UAL without directly affecting existing operations. We looked for anticipated revenue increases or new sources of revenue that had not already been dedicated. We looked at underutilized assets that could be used either to generate additional revenue or sold, and we looked at cash reserves that potentially could be tapped. And I know Alana a little later is going to go into what some of those specific options are that the governor's interested in pursuing at this point. Many of the options that we identified do involve public policy trade-offs. And we know that finding a set of solutions is not going to be easy, but we do hope that the menu of options that we've identified will at least give you some places to start. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
So again, for the record, Ilana Pertle-Guinney here on behalf of the governor's office. Chair Taylor, Senator Knope, I'm going to go through a PowerPoint with a little bit of background around why the governor focused in on the concepts that she did out of the task force report, and then move into some details about what you'll see in a bill. I apologize that we don't have a bill draft to share with you all today. We had a couple of last-minute changes that we were working on, but we will have something that we can drop and make available next week. I want to put what you'll hear today in context of a larger plan to address PERS that the governor has been working through. Last year in the 2017 session, we worked with the Treasurer's Office to secure more internal investment officers. We know we get a high return on our investment for having those investment officers who are working internally rather than contracting out that work. And we were able, with the help of the legislature, to secure a number of additional folks to work internally for them. We also worked with the PERS board to redirect excess reserves and investments toward paying down the UAL. There are a variety of sources where dollars are often split between a number of different accounts, and we directed the PERS board to put those into what's called the Benefits in Force Reserve, which is the pot of money used to pay out benefits and therefore has a direct effect on the unfunded actuarial liability. That allowed us to capture an additional $500 million to put toward paying down the UAL. We also directed the PERS board to find ways to make side accounts more accessible. In the past, because of the costs associated with opening side accounts and the minimum deposits necessary, most employers just used side accounts when they took out pension obligation bonds. And we've worked with the PERS board to lower those barriers as of last month, so that as local governments go through and identify potential pots of money to put toward their liability, they're able to put that into PERS directly through a side account. We also directed PERS to ensure that every employer is better able to understand their rates, their future projected rates, and what the effect of opening a side account would be. There's now a tool available to all PERS employers where they can enter some basic information that they've received from PERS about their rates and about the projections for the system as a whole and get a better understanding of what the effect of opening a side account would be on their future rates that's personalized to that individual employer. That's information that some of our larger employers were able to work through on their own in the past, but that many smaller employers didn't have the resources and staff available to work through.
Yes.
Could I have it sort of clarified? So I think you mentioned to me before that there are some cities that have huge reserve accounts, and possibly some of that money could be used in an incentive account, or?
So I don't know what the size of reserve accounts for all the 900 PERS employers across the state are, but we do know from conversations that our task force members had with various public entities that there are some entities out there who have reserve accounts that they've set aside that they plan on using to address their increased PERS costs, their increased employer rates, but that they have held in their own accounts for a variety of reasons. Not the only reason, but one of the reasons that that's happened is that there wasn't a good way to put it into PERS. The costs to do so were just too high. Those side accounts are now more accessible, so if they chose to, those local governments or other employers could choose to take those dollars out of their own reserves and put it into PERS, where we would then be able to get a better picture of what the unfunded liability really is and how many dollars there are available that employers have to put toward paying that down. So that leads us all to 2018 with the bill that we'll be bringing forward, which we hope will do two things: create a side account for schools specifically, and I'll talk a little bit about why we're focusing there, and then additionally create the employer incentive fund, which Corey talked about that the task force spent some time working on. A number of your colleagues have asked, as we've talked about this bill, why we aren't having a conversation around benefit reform. And I think your committee did a lot of work last session in looking at what the options were around benefits reform. The governor feels at this time like the right piece to work on is paying down the unfunded liability for a variety of reasons, but we also know that there are going to be continuing conversations, and we expect that some of the conversations around employee contributions that came up at the end of last session will likely come back up in the future as well.
Yes, Senator Hansel.
Before we move off of 217, can I ask a couple quick questions?
Go right ahead.
On the first bullet there, secure more internal investment officers, have we done any comparison between what, I don't know how many internal ones we've had, their record versus external on return? How many of each did we cut down on external when we went internal? Can you fill me a little bit on that?
Chair Taylor, Senator Hansel, some of those questions I'd have to direct to the Treasurer's office. I'm not sure how far along they are in the hiring of those internal investment officers to know if they have been able yet to scale back their use of external investors. My understanding is that our internal investment officers over the last 10 or so years have actually had a better track record than the external investment folks who the Treasurer's office has worked with. We do want to keep the portfolio diversified, though, by having both internal investment officers and contracted out work so that we have different approaches to our investments and keep them as diversified and safe as possible. For more details, I would have to direct you to the Treasurer's office, though, and I'm happy to ask them to reach out to you.
Follow up?
Yes.
So when we have internal, it becomes more diversified, then if we cut back, we have to maintain both to be diversified? Is that what you're saying?
Chair Taylor, Senator Hansel, my understanding is that the common thinking around state investment portfolios is that some of that work should be done in-house and some of it should be done through investment firms.
Okay. Another question on the last bullet there under 217, obtain agreement by 90% plus of state employees to contribute to PERS. Can you expand on that a little bit? What is that concept?
Chair Taylor, Senator Hansel, there's been a significant amount of debate over the years around whether employers should stop picking up the 6% IAP contribution that at one point a number of years ago employers bargained to pay on behalf of their employees. And that's a decision that each PERS employer has to make individually. The policy set by the legislature is that either employees or the employer can pay that 6% IAP contribution. Through bargaining over the last few years, the state has moved away from picking up that contribution and instead has moved toward having the vast majority of our state employees pay their IAP contribution.
Oh, so that's already in effect then?
It was bargained through a number of contracts, so those contracts have been signed. The change to those employees paying the contribution themselves has not gone into effect yet for all employees, but we have signed contracts to move in that direction, yes.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, Senator Matusiewicz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is it correct that with all the PERS reforms we've done in the past, if you only focused on the OPSERP, people, that employers would be paying only 10%? Can you clarify that for me?
Chair Taylor, Senator Moniz-Anderson, if I am remembering the numbers correctly, and I unfortunately didn't put the slide in this presentation, the cost associated with the OPSERP program right now is about 9.5% of payroll, as opposed to the much higher rates that employers are paying. That's actually one of the reasons that as the governor looked at next steps to take and convened the PERS UAL task force, we were focused on how we could pay down the UAL, because the UAL, especially that portion of the UAL associated with Tier 1 and Tier 2 retirees, is what's really driving a lot of the costs right now. So you're right, that 10% number is correct. OPSERP costs would be under 10%.
Okay. Another follow-up.
Yes, Senator Hanson.
The first presenter said that the idea is to reduce it $5 billion, a billion a year. Are we being told that those five things that are up there in 2017 will reduce it for $1 billion a year?
The charge, Chair Taylor, Senator Hansel, the charge that the governor laid out to the PERS UAL task force was to try to identify $5 billion that could be captured over 5 years and put toward paying down the PERS UAL. That's separate from the items listed on this slide. The bill that we are bringing forward for the 2018 legislative session does not total $5 billion because, as we looked through the options in the report that you have before you, it was clear to the governor that not all of those were feasible in the short time frame that we had to turn around legislation before February. If you look through that report, though, you'll see that there are a number of options that we're not considering at this time that we could consider moving forward. And if we were to enact all of those, the task force's belief and the information that we received from the task force in the report is that they would total somewhere around $5 billion.
Follow-up?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Then what is the savings that you are proposing to that? Is that in your report?
Chair Taylor, Senator Hansel, as you'll see as I move through these slides, there are a number of proposals that we're bringing forward for which we can't identify a specific cost savings, and I'll explain why. But we do believe that what we have within the bill that we're bringing to you for 2018 would total at a minimum about 10% of that, about $500 million. From there, we hope to work with you all to identify other options in the report that we might be able to consider.
Okay.
So, and I'll run through these first introductory slides quickly. As we look at the unemployability, I mentioned that the governor felt that that was the place where we should be focusing right now. You see a jump in the unfunded liability in 2014 associated with three major changes. The Supreme Court overturning the reforms from earlier from a few years earlier in the Morrow decision led to a jump in $5.1 billion in the UAL. That right there is one of the reasons that Governor Brown has been very clear that she's not interested in changes to the PERS system that would lead to a lengthy court case. We also saw a small increase because the PERS board determined that they needed to reduce the rate of return, and a small increase because the actuaries updated mortality assumptions. People are living longer than they have in the past, and we need to reflect that in the rates. As we look at employer rates over the next 20 years, we see jumps in 1921 and 21-23, then some leveling out. That jump that you see in 29-31 is associated with side accounts expiring. So side accounts that employers opened a number of years ago will reach the end of their amortization period at that time. As we look at a five-year period for putting dollars into side accounts and then an amortization period of those side accounts, what we hope to do is have money in the system that helps to offset increased rates before that jump in 21-23, and then have those dollars amortize over a period of time just long enough to help us smooth that jump that we see again later in the chart in 29-31. So that's the goal here, is to offset some of those cost increases for employers across the state. When we look, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, thanks. I have a question. Yeah. As it relates to the amortization, was that work done by the actuary?
So we're not proposing in the bill an amortization period for the side accounts that are set up. That's a decision that would be made by the PERS board. But as we look at the amortization period of a side account and what the benefits of the dollars in that side account are, depending on the amortization period, those are numbers that we go to the actuaries for, yes.
Okay.
So as we look at the unfunded liability, I believe I mentioned earlier, 70% of that unfunded liability is attributable to retirees and inactive members. And that's the group of people about whom the courts have said we really can't make significant changes to benefits. We have to pay those benefits off. So as we look at paying down the UAL in a different way, that really is for the bulk of the cost driver that we're looking at right now, our option. We can either pay it off in the way that the PERS board lays out with the 20-year amortization period of any debt, or we can pay it off through finding other dollars to put into the system earlier. It's been helpful for us to look at the unfunded liability. To look at the unfunded liability by employer type. And often we talk about this large $21 billion unfunded liability. When you include side accounts, which are dollars that are already in the system to offset those costs, it's actually a $15 billion liability. And that liability is split between a number of employers. So you can see here, the state has about $3.25 billion of that liability. Cities and counties each have about $2 billion of liability. School districts, which ultimately receive the bulk of their funding from the state as well, hold about $5.4 billion of that liability, and then the rest is split among other employers. The third column here is another way that it's been helpful for us to think about employer rates, and that is the UAL, the unfunded liability, as a percent of payroll. So compared to what your payroll is, how much liability do you as an individual employer actually hold? And averaged across employer types, you'll see that there's a range from about 125% to about 175%. And broken down within employer types, we see for the most part, most employers are between 100 and 200% of liability, of payroll for their liability. Particularly within school districts, there's a large number of employers where their liability is actually up over 200% of their total payroll, which is somewhat concerning, and I'll talk more about that as we move on. As we looked at principles for bringing a bill forward, for creating and bringing a bill forward, the governor looked at a number of different things. First of all, making sure that we help all employers meet their own PERS obligations in the best way possible. The task force, through their work, heard from some employers that they were prepared for the increased costs that they saw, the increased employer rates. They had made plans already, and they really didn't want the state to make changes to how they would pay those rates. We heard from other employers that they really hoped to have help. And so one of the principles that we kept in mind was making sure that we allowed flexibility so that with 900 different employers, if you combine the state, still over 700 different employers, could each address paying down their UAL in the way that worked best for them and for their constituents. We also looked at using two different statistics to try to get a handle of where impacts of increases would be the greatest. We looked at the percent of budget that directed to payroll. So if you look at the state, something like 20% of the state's budget goes to payroll. If you look at local governments, I'm told that it's, depending on the government, between a half and two-thirds, although I know Scott Winkles is behind me and may correct that, of budgets go to payroll. When you look at school districts, I'm told it's 80 to 90% of the budget goes to payroll. That affects the flexibility that you have in being able to address changes in your employer rates. We also then looked at that number you saw earlier, total UAL as a percent of payroll, to get a sense of what size increases you would be experiencing based on your payroll size. And then we wanted to, as I showed in that chart, looking at future increases, really look at a three-biennium time frame for getting dollars into the system so that we had them in the system, had those dollars there to offset costs as employers are experiencing the greatest increases. The legislation that we'll be bringing to you has two main focuses: a focus on education, particularly K-12, and how we can create a side account for our K-12 districts, capitalize that with dollars, and help to offset their costs. Our K-12 districts have some of the largest UALs as a percent of their payroll, and they also have some of the least flexibility in terms of the percent of their budget dedicated to payroll. Further, the state is the payer, ultimately, for the bulk of our K-12 districts' budgets. So that really, that lack of flexibility and those increased costs come back to the state budget. And then second of all, looking at ways that we can assist all employers as they try to figure out the best way to address their own UALs. Looking at the education piece of that, we looked at setting up side accounts for education, looking at unclaimed property, one-time funds, and then windfall dollars, and also lottery. I'll go through each of those in more detail. On the assisting all employers side, we looked at creating an employer incentive fund, and then also at a few ways that we could direct deposits specifically into the benefits and force reserve. That's that account within PERS that pays out benefits. Additional dollars into the benefits and force reserve lead to a direct decrease in the UAL, the unfunded liability. So starting on the school side, looking at unclaimed property, we know that less than 50% of unclaimed property historically is eventually claimed. And claims usually come in within about 15 years. So if you look around 2004, 2005, you see that the blue and green bars together start to hit close to the total reported. That blue bar follows right along with the green 50% claim rate. After that, we know that there are a number of other claims to come in that we haven't gotten yet. What the bill proposes is that we take 35% of reported unclaimed property and direct it to a side account for education. Depending on the time frame within which we do that, you have between $140 million and $265 million. We're guessing that what we would be looking at is about $200 million. With a claim rate of under 50% and a high mark at 58%, plus an additional 35% of reported dollars going to a side account specifically for our K-12 schools, we still fall below that blue line of total reported unclaimed property. So we think that we can safely divert that amount of money while still not having claims come in that we're unable to pay. We also are including language in the bill with a stopgap to ensure that if additional claims come in, there's a way to back some dollars out to pay those claims so that we don't end up falling back on the general fund.
Question. Could you explain a little bit what the unclaimed property is all about? I think I know, but I want to make sure I'm on the same track.
Absolutely. So unclaimed property comes from a number of sources, and this chart actually starts in 1996 because in the early 1990s there were changes to the statute around what constituted unclaimed property. That can come in when an Oregonian passes away and an heir is not able to be found and their estate defaults to the state. That can occur when somebody has a tax refund that they never collect on. That can occur when somebody leaves funds in a bank account past a period of time, and I apologize, I don't know what the length of time is, but after a set period of time, those dollars default back to the state. The state holds those dollars in trust so that if somebody is interested in coming and claiming that property in the future, they're able to do so.
But as you see,
We hold it currently indefinitely in trust, but as you see, and if I extended this chart back prior to 1996, you'd see a pretty consistent pattern there. That blue bar at the bottom is the amount of dollars claimed. The green line is the 50% claim rate. And you see there's only 2 years where we get above 50% there. It was about 57% for 1999 and 58% for 2004. But the average is around 48, 49% claim rate. And that's a pretty consistent historic average.
Thank you.
The second type of revenue stream that we're looking at dedicating toward a side account for our K-12 schools are one-time revenue streams. In 2017, this body passed a bill that included direction to increase debt collection. The state is attempting to increase debt collection 10% above what was collected in 2017 over the 17-19 biennium. We expect that to be equal to about $50 million. We'd like to dedicate those funds to paying down or to offsetting costs for our K-12 schools within PERS. We are looking at dedicating future lawsuit settlements. There's an unknown there because we don't know what those settlements might be and what they might bring. But lawsuit settlements that are not dedicated to other purposes would be dedicated to a side account within PERS for our K-12 schools. And then finally, in 2009, the legislature passed what was called a tax amnesty bill. It essentially said that if you had back taxes owed and you paid 50% of your late fees, fines, penalties would be waived. That brought in about $40 million. About $20 million of that, the Department of Revenue was already trying to track down, but about $20 million of that were new dollars that the Department of Revenue had not identified. So we're including a new tax amnesty portion to the bill to capture back taxes owed that we may not otherwise see paid to the state. The third revenue stream is what are called windfalls or revenue upsides. So there are a number of places where we have volatile revenue sources. And if we look at an average across a number of years, we'd like to capture what comes in above that average on years when volatility spikes up. We're looking at capital gains and estate taxes, beer, wine, and marijuana taxes. We understand that marijuana taxes are a little bit up in the air right now, but we expect to be able to continue with that program. A critical piece of this portion of the bill is that if the kicker kicks, these upsides, these windfalls, don't go into the PERS side account, the UAL side account for education. We don't want to take those upsides and put them both into that side account and then have to pay them out in the kicker. So this would only apply in years where there was a windfall and no kicker. We can't get a really accurate idea of what that would be looking forward, particularly because with federal tax reform, we know there's going to be a significant amount of volatility in a number of these areas, especially capital gains and estate taxes. We asked our folks, our financial folks, though, to do a regression to look at what over the last 10 years this would have meant had it been in place 10 years ago. And what they found is that over the last five biennia, this would have triggered a deposit in one biennium in 2011-2013, and in that biennium, the capital gains piece alone would have been in the amount of $192 million. So there's a lot of variability here. One of the reasons we can't give you a firm number on what we expect this bill to bring to a site account is because this section has so much, so many unknowns, but that's the type of scale that we're talking about. The final piece of the education portion of the bill is directing growth in lottery revenues through new games, new users, and new platforms to a series of site accounts. So far, we've been talking just about K-12 districts. The lottery portion in the bill would be split between K-12 universities and community colleges. A few key things about this piece of the bill. We know that the Lottery Commission is considering a number of new game types and platforms right now. The potential revenue from this bill is incredibly, or from this portion of the bill, is incredibly variable based on how many of those new things under consideration actually come to fruition. That's based on a series of policy decisions that the PERS UAL paydown bill is silent on. We're not getting into lottery policy here. What we're doing is saying, should policy decisions be made that lead to a significant increase in lottery revenue, for a six-year period, those dollars before they go to other program, and I should clarify, those dollars after constitutional obligations. So those new dollars after constitutional obligations, should new games be approved, should go toward paying down the unfunded liability within PERS for our educational institutions. Again, we're not talking about lottery policy, and this would all occur after the constitutional obligations to which lottery dollars go. So the second portion of the bill looks at how we can help all employers address their own liabilities. And the main way in which we're proposing to do that is through an employer incentive fund, which was a key piece of the work done by the PERS UAL task force. Within the bill, we create the employer incentive fund. We are not capitalizing it. The governor thought that it was important to work with the legislature to figure out the best way to capitalize this fund, and there are a number of policy conversations that we need to have about where those dollars should come from. The governor also felt, though, that we shouldn't delay in creating the structure for this fund because we need to signal as soon as possible to employers across the state that these dollars will be available. If we expect local governments to set aside funds that they have coming in the door or to free up dollars that are in their own internal reserves to put into a side account in PERS, we need to give them time through their budgeting process to have those conversations, which is why we're proposing the creation of the fund, although we're waiting to capitalize it until a future point. The way that the fund is created within the bill is that it would provide 25 cents on the dollar match for asset capital deposited into a side account. In the past, most capital deposited into side accounts has been through pension obligation bonds, which, as the bill is currently written, wouldn't qualify for this match. This would be available to employers with the largest debt and the smallest budgets first, so that they have an opportunity to secure funds. After they had an opportunity over about a six-month period to secure funds, we would open up those matching funds to all employers within the PERS system. There would also be a cap. There's a cap included for each individual employer to ensure that those employers with the largest budgets don't eat up the bulk of the fund before other employers have had an opportunity to secure their matches. This was a critical piece of the work done by the task force. And as we look at the breakdown of the UAL by employer types that I showed on an earlier slide, it was critical to the governor that we bring forward something to try to help those entities as they address their own unfunded liabilities.
Question.
Senator Hansel.
Do you have any anticipation of what that would raise, like 25, or what would be needed for approximate, I mean, what, like in bullet number one?
So the task force, Chair Taylor, Senator Hansel, the task force proposed an idea that would bring in about $400 million, which is the number that the governor has been focusing on as well. That's a scalable number, though. Similarly, the match of 25 cents on the dollar was a proposal from the task force, but is also scalable. Our intention is to have a match that is high enough that it can truly incentivize local employers to put dollars into side accounts to pay down their or to offset their future employer costs, but that the match is also low enough that there are enough dollars to spread across all interested employers. 25 cents on the dollar seemed like about the right number to us. We're open to a conversation if that number seems wrong, though, to you and your colleagues.
Follow up. Is the 25 cents the investment of the state to match a dollar of their employer?
Chair Taylor, Senator Hansel, that's correct. For every dollar that an employer put into a side account, the employer incentive fund would provide 25 cents. So if an employer put in, let's say, $100,000, the employer incentive fund would put in $25,000. If an employer put in $1 million, the employer incentive fund would put in $250,000, and so on.
Follow up.
Yes, sir.
The total of $400 million then represents what? Input of both, or one or the other, or what?
Chair Taylor, Senator Hansel, $400 million is the amount of money to capitalize the employer incentive fund that the task force had looked for.
But where does it come from?
That is, where does it come from, meaning where did we get the number $400 million, or where will we get that $400 million?
The second.
So, Chair Taylor, Senator Hansel, that's the piece of this that we would like to have a conversation with the legislature about. We believe that there are a number of critical policy decisions, policy conversations to have around where those dollars come from, whether those dollars come from a specific appropriation, whether they come from a specific identified revenue source. I have had a few people ask if we would be interested in looking at bonding for that.
My question is more of a clarification one for me. The $400 million is the state's 25% estimate of – the $400 million is the estimate of what it would cost the state at 25% on the $1 match. Is that what I'm hearing?
Chair Taylor, Senator Hansel, yes, that's correct. So the final piece of the bill, also in the category of how do we help all employers, is looking for ways that we can make deposits directly into the benefits in force reserve. And the main piece of this that you'll see when the bill is dropped is that we are asking the Treasurer's Office to study the possibility of reinvesting some of the funds that they hold in other ways that might lead to higher returns. The Treasurer's Office has suggested that there may be potential here, but that they would need to do a significant amount of looking to figure out how we could do that in a way that was secure, that did not add excessive additional risk to the dollars that the treasurer holds, but that could also lead to an upside, the difference of which, that upside from which, could be deposited directly into the benefits of force reserve to help pay down that debt directly and create a benefit for all employers within the system.
Okay.
With that, I am happy to take
well
additional
done.
Questions.
Well done, you did a good job. That was a lot to cover. And again, we don't have the bill yet, but we're hoping maybe, when are we thinking?
Late this week or early next week.
Okay, great. So there'll be some time to have some additional questions and to go over some details. Does anybody have any questions right now? Yes, Senator Hansel.
Not so much a question, but more of a statement maybe that on the third slide, the title is encouraging to me because it says, why is the unfunded liability the immediate problem? The word problem and immediate, the recognition of that in the presentation and from the governor's office is encouraging, and that we have absolutely got to do something about it.
Thank you for that, Senator.
Taylor, Senator, thank you.
Thank you for that, Senator Hansel. I think it's great that we're, and I want to thank the coming to represent the task force, and thank you for all the work that you did. It sounds like that probably was more fun sometimes and maybe not so fun at other times, and so thank you for your service and doing that. And I, too, think it's great that the governor's office is taking this very seriously, and we need to do something, and obviously a great deal of thought has been put into this, so thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Right. Moving on, now we will close the informational meeting on the Public Employees Retirement System, UAL paydown, and we're open an informational meeting on home care workers training. The Oregon Home Care Commission provides support to home care and personal support workers. In a recent report, the Home Care Commission noted that Oregon is viewed nationally as a leader in home care and personal support worker organization and practices, but that the increasing demand for in-home care, as well as the unique employment circumstances for home care and personal support workers, requires continuous improvement of the system. Today, we'll hear more about the Home Care Commission's report and recommendations for improvements in training standards and opportunities for home care workers. So we're going to go ahead and bring forward John Bartholomew, Nicole Palmatier, Hazel Baker, Christine Berry, Diane Caitlin, and Sunshine Bodie. But I see, who are we? Can you help me out here, Deborah? Who are we bringing up first here?
Do you have an order?
I believe I'm going first.
Okay, tell me your name, please.
My name's Kristen Berry.
Kristen Berry. Okay, so let's just go over this before we start. So you're going to go first, and then who's going to go after you?
Is there anybody else?
Do you want to go after John?
Yeah.
Okay, John. And then, hello, tell me.
Diane Catlin.
Okay. And then is Nicole here and Sunshine?
She'll be with John.
I'll go with John. Okay. Diane should go last. Mm-hmm. Okay, and where's Nicole?
She's right there.
Sorry. I thought that was sorry. Okay, so Christine, excuse me, I'm not feeling well, so I apologize.
No, it's okay.
Go ahead.
Right. Yeah. Thank you very much. My name is Kristen Berry, and I'm with Thomas P. Miller and Associates. We are a consulting firm that was hired by the Oregon Home Care Commission in February 2017. To help facilitate a strategic planning process to develop a workforce development strategic plan as was directed in Senate Bill 774 to continue some of those planning efforts. So we really wanted to look at how best to increase the size of the home care workforce in the state of Oregon, and then beyond just increasing the size, how to make sure that it's an accurate reflection of the demand of consumer employers within the state and that these workers have the support that they need to be successful. So the strategic planning process, like I said, began in February of 2017, and the activities were completed over the course of about 4 months. One of the most important pieces of the process for the commission was to get as wide of an array of input as possible from as many stakeholders as possible. So to do that, we completed a few different activities. We released a survey to providers, got responses from about 350 home care and personal support workers. We conducted focus groups in several areas of the state with workers and with local field office staff, and also conducted 12 interviews with leaders from the commission, from the agency, and also from the SEIU. Throughout all of those activities, we were really aimed at understanding why workers are drawn to this field, what are the benefits that we can really talk about when we're trying to get more workers involved, and also what are the challenges and obstacles that they're facing, both to entering the workforce and also to being able to be supported and stay in the workforce. We also conducted two strategic planning sessions. The commission had a really strong participation from the Workforce Development Committee to help identify, hearing all of the responses from the stakeholder engagement activities to identify the priorities for action moving forward to address some of the challenges, and then turn those into goals and strategies and actions to really outline the work of the next 3 to 5 years. And the last piece I wanted to make sure that I mentioned that was that we also really focused on best practices research throughout this process to make sure that the resulting plan was not creating brand new things in every area, but also leveraging practices that have worked across the country and not reinventing the wheel everywhere, but learning from lessons from other areas. Some of the key findings from the stakeholder engagement activities that we did, two of the biggest themes of positive feedback that we heard were related to job satisfaction of the workers, as well as the satisfaction with the pay and benefits offered. The workers emphasized that they really were in this job because they enjoyed helping people and they liked caring for others, and that really brought a lot of satisfaction to the position, and also recognized that we know that Oregon is a national leader in providing a strong package of pay and benefits to these workers, and the workers reflected that as well. We also learned that the majority of these workers found out about the position and getting into the field from other workers. So those are also both strong things to emphasize as they're referring their friends and their peers to enter the field. On the flip side, some of the most cited challenges or barriers were related more to administrative processes or access to training. One of the most common commonly mentioned challenges was the outdated technology or processes requiring the length of time required to go through some of the application processes due to utilizing hard copy materials, the time it would take from application to getting employment and that first paycheck. The other most commonly cited barrier was related to training. And this took multiple forms, both the content of the training that was available, but also access to training and whether it was offered in the correct or the most beneficial times and locations or available electronically. So reviewing all of the information we heard from stakeholders with the Workforce Development Committee, they created three goals for moving forward. The first one is around professionalizing the workforce. So to position home care and personal support workers as trained and credentialed professionals. This is really important in ensuring that these workers provide a consistent high standard of care to consumers. And training is really the critical piece of this. Just that the resources and the support are available for workers to increase their skills and continuously improve in providing their services. Professionalizing this occupation also helps it to feel more like a career and less like a job, more like something that can be available for the long term. The strategies identified for this goal, the first is related to credentials. Providing skills that can be recognized by employers as they are hiring workers, but also that could be credentialed for those workers who would like to advance in other areas of caregiving or healthcare occupations, providing skills that can be transferable. The second is related to expanding the ways that training is provided to be able to increase access and also using multiple platforms to ensure that workers who learn in different ways can have different methods of taking those trainings. And the third is related to creating a supportive environment among peers and administrators for workers to really create a culture of support. And for those workers who, they're working one-on-one with a consumer employer, it's easy to feel isolated. And we heard that a little bit from providers in the survey. So creating a culture that there are resources to reach out to and that there is support available. The second goal that was identified is around attracting and retaining workers, and not just workers, but the right workers that are the right fit and that can be retained in the field moving forward, that are passionate and successful. This is definitely related to the first goal. We know that training and promoting a professional environment is really important in engaging workers to keep them in the field. But there were also several additional strategies identified for this, the first being to simplify and streamline the administrative processes, really about retention, making sure that we're able to attract workers into the field, but also we're making it easy for them to stay and not contributing to frustrations that make them look elsewhere. The second is related to really understanding consumer employer demand, both in demographics and in the type of skills that they need for their services, and targeting marketing efforts toward those populations that can help fill can fill those gaps between the current workforce and what is being demanded. And the third strategy is related to partnerships. And in doing this marketing and outreach, utilizing relationships to tap into existing networks and not having to recreate everything without current connections already available. And the third goal is around facilitating the connections between providers and consumer employers and making that easier for both sides. The strategies here are really about better improving the technology that is being utilized to make those connections in the OHCC registry, making it user-friendly, making it continuously updated to ensure that it's staying up to date with the competition of other websites that are available publicly. And the second strategy being to build upon current programs that can help to educate consumer employers, making sure that they are able to make the best hiring decisions for themselves and able to communicate effectively with their workers. So in the full plan, there are also 17 action initiatives. I have copies of the plan here if you'd like them. I won't go through each of them in detail in the interest of time, but we also outlined these to ensure that there's clear next steps. They each include guidelines for timelines, whether it's an initial action to be taken in the first 6 months or whether it might take 3 to 5 years, who needs to be involved, potential obstacles, and where there exist best practices that could be learned from moving forward. A lot of work. A lot of them are based off of leveraging work that was already being started or conceptualized, and so work has begun on some of them. And I want to mention a few that are really important to this training piece that we're here talking about today. In the goal of professionalizing the workforce, identified that developing an assessment to help workers identify the training that they do need that would be beneficial to them to increasing their skills, promoting credentials, like I mentioned before, to be able to advertise your skills and show that you have completed trainings. Looking at expanding training sources, utilizing training that already exists, and seeing where the gaps need to be filled in creating new training, and implementing a learning management system to leveraging technology where possible to really expand access across the state. These were just four of the focuses that I wanted to mention that we identified to really promote that professionalizing workforce and increasing skills as we're moving forward.
Anybody have any questions? Thank you. That was really very informative. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Okay, next we'll hear from we're going to have John and Nicole. Yeah, so John Bartholomew and Nicole Hazelbacker. Baker. Hello.
Chair Taylor, members of the work group, members of the committee. For the record, Nicole Pommetier, Hazel Baker here today on behalf of O4AD, the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities, which is why we call it O4AD, because that's a lot to say. We represent the 17 area agencies around the state, serving all 36 counties in senior and disabilities services. We have been working with SEIU as well as other stakeholders on this topic of workforce training. Within the area agencies, we interact with the home care workers in a variety of programs, Oregon Project Independence, as well as Medicaid long-term services and supports. We have found that as well as the continual challenges in recruiting a workforce that meets the needs that are continuing to increase because we have a rapidly growing aging population. We also have found that the new demands from various federal regulations, various other new things that have come down and need to be implemented, have put an increasing strain as well on case managers. A lot of times a home care worker will reach out to the case manager first for help, for the technical support that was just talked about, for counsel on how to deal with issues going from vouchers to scheduling to things like that. While Oregon does have a client employer program, that doesn't necessarily mean that the client is the person whom the home care worker is able to receive the support from. Case managers carry a huge amount of work, a tremendous amount of stress trying to meet the needs of the consumer. This is another piece that's inadvertently being added on top of that, which takes away from the time that they have to work with the consumer, which is their primary responsibility. We are very supportive of this work. We believe that by broadening and strengthening training and broadening and strengthening the kind of support that we give to home care workers. We continue to professionalize this very, very critical workforce and continue to provide more opportunity to increase the number of people who are interested in taking on this very important work. We're entrusting these people to take care of our most vulnerable citizens. It's one of the most important jobs that we see on a day-to-day basis. We understand that there are some suggestions for different revisions or different changes to the language that's currently being worked through, and I think everybody is committed to working towards together to that to find a vehicle that can move forward here in the very near future. I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have, but O4AD is certainly in support of this.
Okay. Thank you. Chair Taylor, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Bartholomew. I'm the Government Relations Director for AARP Oregon. We have over 510,000 members across the state. And we're here today to lend support for the proposal to improve the level of competency and professionalism for home care workers in Oregon. One of the key elements of the term home care worker is the word home. The vast majority of people who need long-term supports and services want to stay at home for as long as they possibly can, because home is security, home is community, and home is family. Home care workers help folks stay in their own homes for longer, and with improved training that this bill sets in motion, we expect people will be able to stay in their own homes for even longer. But I want to point out that this is not just about the people who receive the direct care from home care workers. A great number of people who are served by home care workers and personal support workers also have a family caregiver or two or three that is providing care when the home care worker is not around. There are about 470,000 family caregivers across Oregon that provide over $5.7 billion worth of uncompensated care each year. And the stress of that family caregiving is proven to be emotional stress, physical stress, and a financial burden on those family caregivers. And that leads to higher health care costs for those family caregivers as well. Just the family caregivers of people with Alzheimer's disease is over $100 million per year in higher health care costs because of the stresses. Home care workers and personal support workers can provide much needed respite for those family caregivers. In 2016, AARP coordinated a family caregiver respite work group with a lot of folks in this room. And we visited 17 communities across Oregon, I think two in your district, in fact. And it was all about how can we get greater access to respite, greater usage of respite for family caregivers. We found that in many communities, there's a shortage of quality home care workers. Not always a shortage of home care workers, but a shortage of quality home care workers. And that's what this proposal gets at, is improving the quality, the professionalism, the training levels for the folks that we have. One of the recommendations of our work group report, the respite work group report that the legislature did endorse last year with HJM-4, was to improve the quality and quantity of home care workers who can provide respite services. Since that's what this proposal aims to do, that is why we are supporting it. And I wanted to add another piece of HJM-4 was to it was for the legislature to say to our congressional delegation, we urge you to pass the Raise Family Caregivers Act at the federal level. Yesterday, the Senate gave final approval of that, and it's headed to the president's desk for a signature. So, supporting the family caregivers, supporting the people who receive services directly, increased training is only going to help.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you both very much. Okay, so now we'll call up Sunshine Bodie.
Hi. I'm Sunshine Bodie. And really grateful for the opportunity to come here and talk about the importance of training for workers, for children and adults with developmental disabilities. We have the elderly mentioned here, but they're another group that receives supports and services. So I come as a parent because I have a child with a developmental disability. He's also had a heart transplant. So because of the severity of his disability and his medical fragility, we've had caregivers for 7 years. But I also run a program at the Arc of Lane County where we seek to assist families in hiring and helping to manage those relationships with personal support workers, since that's not a skill set that the average person actually has, and it takes a lot of time and energy to do. From both of those experiences, I could talk about hundreds of examples of the negative effects of placing an unsupported and untrained workforce into a really important and difficult job. But the one I'm going to talk about today is from my own life, my own experience, and my own worker in my home. So I come home from work one day, and my sweet and kind of soft-spoken caregiver for my son is getting ready to leave, and he casually mentions over his shoulder, "So leave choked today," and I gave him the Heimlich. No. And I had to kind of stop and let this sink in. My son, like many people with IDD, have an increased propensity for choking, either because of apraxia of the mouth or tongue, or they sometimes have sensory-seeking behaviors around their mouth, or they have pica, where they put non-food objects in their mouth. And in his case, all three of those things. And so it really hit me in that moment that if he had not had the CPR choking protocol training that he'd had at a previous incarnation in his life, that I probably wouldn't be sitting here as a mother of a thriving, growing 14-year-old. I've been here, sitting here with a son lost. So I did what I could do personally, which is I became a first aid CPR choking protocol instructor and began delivering that to direct support professionals in agencies like the ARC. But these are people that work in facilities. Mm-hmm. Because the mechanism and the funding and the requirement that in-home workers have this training doesn't exist. And so basically I come here today to let you know that you have it within your power to provide the requirement and the funding to make sure that in-home workers can stop these unnecessary deaths and injuries that are inevitable if we don't give the right training to our in-home workers.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing that story. I'm glad your son is okay.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Okay. All right. Now we'll call up Diane Catlin.
Catlin,
sorry. I apologize.
Leave the I out.
Sorry. I apologize.
Okay. I'm a little nervous today because I haven't spoke in front of a large group like this.
No, you know what? You're okay. I can I can barely talk. I'm so I have such a head cold, so I apologize for that. Anyway, welcome.
Thank you. For those who didn't hear, my name is Diane Catlin, and I've been a home care worker and personal support worker for 6 years. I found it important to attend Oregon Home Care trainings, commission trainings, and I learned something new or relearned things that have strengthened my ability to care for another. Just yesterday, I was speaking to a personal support worker who cares for her daughter who has a developmentally disability. I was sharing her my training booklet, which is this, and I have all my certificates and things like that, and she noticed that I had a bathing and grooming, and so she said, "Oh," she says, that's such a difficult chore for her and her daughter, because the daughter didn't like to be naked." And I said, "You know, they train you in the course that you can cover them up. You can put towels over them. You can pin them. You can make a toga, and." This way, it's a way to bathe an adult without embarrassing them, without them feeling violated. Mm-hmm. So it makes the task pleasant for both the employer and the caregiver. Home care workers and personal support workers need to know that they can obtain trainings to do their job better. I myself would like to see more in-depth training. My younger coworkers and I concur that these trainings should be enough to take them to the next step towards earning a CNA certificate and on up. Important training such as fraud and abuse, respiratory care, dementia and Alzheimer's, substance abuse awareness, diabetes, medication safety, preventive disease transmission, CPR and first aid, to name a few, are crucial for our services. Being able to take these classes on a yearly basis helps to strengthen our knowledge and keeps us current. Classes need to be made more available and access to all caregivers in all areas. They're basically in the local Portland area, Salem, Eugene, and so those that are on the outskirts have to drive quite a ways to come to class. Anyway, we have multilingual and ethnic employers. We have English, Russian, Chinese, Vietnamese, Spanish are just a few of the languages spoken by people who receive these supports and services. There are very few classes offered to caregivers outside the major metropolitan area and to those who use public transportation. And because of accessibility and the fact that they are not mandated, few workers take the training. By mandating them, we can assure that people are getting trained and therefore increasing the quality of supportive services. I am fortunate enough to drive, so I take classes in Portland, Beaverton, Hillsboro, Tigard, Woodburn, and as far away as McMinnville and Salem when they're offered. And I make sure I take a back-to-back course so that it's worth my time and drive to go there. Wouldn't it be helpful to be able to take all classes within a local proximity of our residential area? Please take some time to look through the material provided to the committee as it highlights this issue as a national crisis. It has bipartisan support, and that Oregon is in a unique position to stay ahead of the curve on this. Let's not wait till a disaster happens. So thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of my coworkers, and I'm excited to work with you on passing smart legislation this coming session.
Well, you know what? You did a great job. Thank you so much. Okay, does anybody have any questions? All right. Okay, got off the hook.
You.
No questions.
Yes.
All right.
I'm sorry?
You're off the hook. No questions.
All right. Thank
yeah.
you.
Okay, thank you. All right, so we're going to go ahead and close the informational meeting on home care workers training, and we're going to open an informational meeting on paid family and medical leave. In the last two committee meetings, we received information about paid family and medical leave programs in other states and heard from a few individuals and local businesses there is a need for a paid family and medical leave program in Oregon. Representative Williamson and I have created a paid family and medical leave work group to evaluate the issue more thoroughly. The work group includes five members of the Legislative Assembly and a diverse group of stakeholders. Legislative members include myself, Representative Williamson, Senator Canope, Representative Lively, a Republican member of the House to be named. The stakeholders include representatives from the Northwest Grocery Association, Oregon Wheat Growers, Columbia Gorge Fruit Growers, Oregon Resource Association, Oregon Farm Bureau Federation, Oregon Business and Industry, Oregon AFL-CIO, Family Forward Oregon, PACOON, League of Oregon Cities, the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries, and the Oregon Department of Consumer and Business Services. Wow, there'll be a lot of us there. Okay. Periodically, the work group meetings will be open for anyone to attend. The intention is for the work group to meet during the short session and throughout the 2018 interim. We understand that there is a House bill for the short session as well. Our committee staff, Deborah Marinoff, will be staffing this work group and will be distributing agendas, materials, and so on. Today, we will be screening a 20-minute documentary about paid family medical leave called 0 Weeks. This is currently showing in film festivals around the country. We're going to go ahead and start the we're going to go right into the video. Is that what we're going to do? Mm-hmm. Okay. Just as a side note, I went to they had a showing of this at the Salem Library. Maybe it was a month or 6 weeks ago. When was that? Something like that. And I had the privilege of going to see the entire film, and it was well attended, and it was very, very moving. So I'm sorry we can't see the whole movie, but we're going to see this short 20-minute clip. So it kind of feels like at school where you get a little bit of a relief where you get to watch a movie during the day. So that's what we're gonna do here.
I went to work every day. I left on my lunch break and did radiation and went back to work.
I end up working 3 days after my daughter was born. There's nothing we can really do.
I might not have a job to come back to.
I found myself sitting in a cubicle at work while my son is in the hospital really fighting for his life, and that's a decision no parent should have to make.
This society is built and geared up to just break down the family, you know, and to just split it up.
Paid leave is part of the economic and social fabric of the entire industrialized world. Except the United States of America.
People know that the Western European countries are doing better on these policies than we are. But countries like Estonia, Lithuania, Bulgaria,
Vietnam has a generous paid leave policy. China has paid leave.
We and only one other country are the only ones that don't have any paid leave.
It's Papua New Guinea and the United States in a league of their own.
We are a great nation. We do a lot of things very well. But in terms of paid family and medical leave, we are far, far, far behind.
Why is it that the rest of the world has figured this out and we haven't?
We are a great and mighty country. The U.S. boasts the world's largest economy and the most powerful military. But of the 39 industrialized countries, we rank 34th in life expectancy, 28th in gender equality, and dead last in maternal health, child health, and family-friendly policies. When it comes to happiness, we rank 19th. Hundreds of experts think paid leave is the missing piece. Paid family and medical leave differs from paid sick days, which we use for routine illnesses that require only a few days for recovery. Paid family leave covers a longer amount of time, usually weeks, to tend to a new child, serious illness, or aging family member. Small businesses overwhelmingly support it. 83% of Democrats support it.
Paid family leave! This is something that must happen!
71% of Republicans support it.
You are from a right-leaning think tank, and you like this as well.
We believe that the U.S. Needs a paid family leave policy at the federal level.
It's proven everyone can use paid family leave.
Every worker in this country will have a life event, an ill family member, a sick spouse, a dying parent, or a new child.
Paid leave is important, first of all, if you have your own illness. What if you discover you have some serious chronic disease?
Uniform pants? Your homework pants?
No.
No? What you gonna wear?
Some dresses.
A dress? But it's gonna be cold tomorrow. Go to college? Because I say so. Watch me learn. Watch me grow.
Breast cancer is very painful.
When I first met with my oncologist, his recommendation was for me to go on disability throughout my whole treatment. Realistically, that's not something I could do. Disability will only pay me $1,600 a month. My rent is $1,100. Electric, gas, you know, all the necessities. I don't get no assistance from the government or anywhere. That worry of me choosing between work, kids, roof, food, that's an everyday struggle. I would get chemo that Thursday, go back and get the shot that Friday, and I had Saturday and Sunday to heal. So most of the time, I was back at work that Monday.
Hi. I'm a superstar every day. Don't you know that?
I'm still not healed from my surgery last year.
So she's gone through several infections. Several times she's had to be rehospitalized. But then when she goes in the hospital, that's when she gets her rest.
If the employers would have just went on and gave me these 2 months off, I would be on a different level while I'm at work. Instead of me being at work and just in constant pain and struggling to get my work done.
One of the most difficult things for a physician is to realize that what's in the best interest of their patients are not doable. I know what's associated with the best outcomes, but I know that the patients can't do it because they've got to decide, do I want to do what my doctor says, or do I want to be employed and have money so I can buy the food that my child is going to need? Which of these competing needs takes precedence when all of them should be met?
My doctor was just like, nobody told you to go back to work so soon. Your body went through so much, just giving birth to like a whole human being. You shouldn't just go back to work.
I think 12 weeks paid leave for mothers is a floor. It takes 6 weeks just to get your physical being back to its normal place.
The other issue paid family leave impacts is breastfeeding.
Breastfeeding is one of the best things you can do for a child's immune system. You're more likely to breastfeed for a longer period of time, clearly, if you have more time off. That's been shown in study after study.
I have no idea what I'm going to do with little girls. You can think you're going to raise a little princess and she turns into a tomboy, or you think I'm going to make her a tomboy, you end up with a closet filled with little princess dresses.
I'm just really excited. I've always known I was meant to be a mom.
Today we just had our 18-week scan of the babies, and they are healthy and beautiful and growing perfectly, and I'm very, very happy.
My company's just really great. They do pay for 1 month paid maternity leave.
I'll be able to take some time off, but I think it would be frowned upon.
You just don't expect to go into labor, obviously, 6 months in.
From the moment her water broke, the girls were both born within 15 minutes. They were born about 2-3 minutes apart. Riley lived for 45 minutes to an hour. Ashlyn lived for 4.5 hours.
I remember when we knew we were going to lose them. Nurses kept saying, do you have a hat or a blanket that you'd like them to wear? And I kept saying no, because I thought I had 3 months of pregnancy left. So I felt, I don't know why, I think that's just a mom thing. I just felt really bad that I didn't have any have anything for them. But they have this volunteer group, I think, at the hospital that crochets them and stuff for situations like this.
The doctor was looking at her and he's like, you can't leave her alone. She needs someone to be with her all the time. I reached out to HR and she said, well, you know, it's 3 days for death of an immediate family member, but technically you get 6 days because there were two deaths.
I think of 6 days, and I just wanted to be like, okay, do you want me to tell you what the first 6 days was like for us? Day one, you're holding your children while they die. Day two, you wake up, relive the nightmare all over again. You go home to package slips that you have a delivery, and it's two car seats from his aunt and uncle from our registry. Day three, you have to find some way to memorialize them, and you realize you don't want to do a funeral and there's no time. So, you know, we had a little memorial through pink tulips into the lake and wrote letters to them. Day four, you have to get all the paperwork done. You have to go to the funeral home. Picking out an urn. Day five, his family left. Day six, my family left. So those were our 6 days.
We're getting people to sign postcards to their senators saying, yes, I want people to be able to be good parents and good children without going broke.
All they have to do to sign? That's
right.
Ellen Bravo has been advocating for paid leave since the early 80s.
That's compassionate single mother with the two kids. She's the one who's working at the brewery because she needs to make a decent living.
Companies are prospering because they treat people with respect.
I don't know if you realize what you're saying. What you're saying
is... I always realize what I'm saying.
Well, all right.
Our movement is building broad and diverse coalitions. Every one of our coalitions has small business owners as partners. And that's because they really want this for their staff, but can't afford to do it on their own. They understand the need for this policy.
We've surveyed employers in California who've had paid leave for 10 years. Overwhelmingly, 90% of businesses said no negative impact on their bottom line or a positive impact. And they say in terms of morale and retention and goodwill, 99% support it.
Small businesses are the backbone of the American economy. In fact, more than half of the U.S. workforce is employed by a small business. And despite the myth that paid leave hurts small businesses, many of them are offering some paid leave on their own, even though it's not required by law in their state.
In These Times offers 13 weeks of fully paid maternity and paternity leave.
Part of the reason for doing that was to maintain and keep employees.
I think Rachel might have left if we had not had good maternity leave. She's really valuable to us because she just gets the magazine out every month. She's also our longest time employee, so she has this incredible institutional memory. Certainly, Rachel could double her salary, possibly more than that with her experience.
If they had no maternity policy, I probably definitely left.
Hi, how you doing? Yeah, we are. Here's my news.
Our employee Mari had a baby a couple months ago, and she has been with us since the day we opened.
Josh and Christine told me, you're going to have 3 months leave and you're going to have paid maternity leave. So when they said that, I had like a huge amount of distress just fall off me. I think about my future, but I don't see myself at another job. I see myself growing more with Honey Butterfly Chicken.
I think that these are like long run expenses. Health insurance and paid time off certainly cost us money, but we built it into the structure of our business because it's not a viable business if you can't take care of the people that are working for you.
If DC approves a new paid leave proposal, it would be one of, if not the most employee-friendly plans in the country.
Today is the third hearing they've had, and this one is focusing on the people who live in the district.
My name is Roger Horwitz, and I own Pleasant Pops. We're a DC small business. As a responsible employer, I'd love to be able to offer paid leave to my employees. At Pleasant Pops, we offer a living wage and paid sick leave. We provide health care, even though we aren't required to do so. And these choices have paid off. Our business has been very successful because we invest in our great employees. But there's one piece missing. We can't provide paid leave because we don't have the cash on hand to cover 16 weeks of leave. We're behind you 100%. And we'll continue to fight for this benefit as small business owners, as DC residents, and as future parents.
Paid family leave becoming law in DC. DC Council voted 9-4 to give more than 500,000 DC employees up to 8 weeks of leave.
There are 9 yeses and 4 noes.
The measure passes.
I want to study to be a radiologist. This is my dad and I. You know, he had long hair. July 4th, my dad was not feeling good. He had leukemia. He was working at a company as a forklift driver. His job told him, obviously, since you're sick, you can't work with us, so he was fired. My mom, at that time, she was working with him, and they fired her because they didn't want her to make excuses to miss a work day or something. July 31st, my dad passed away. I started missing a lot of days at school. I stopped going there my junior year. I was devastated. I was like, what am I going to do? If my mom had her job, it would be easier. You know, I'd be going to school, not worrying about anything, you know.
Sometimes it's hard to explain to people why paid family medical leave has such a high return on investment and is so important. And I've started to have a visual picture of why.
The sticky floor. It's one of the reasons why two-thirds of minimum wage earners are women, because too many of them get stuck on the sticky floor of not being able to earn enough seniority to increase their pay. Because every time a life event happens, they start over again on the bottom rung.
We shouldn't leave all this talent on the sidelines. It hurts our global competitiveness to do so. In the year 2000, female labor force participation in Canada and the United States was identical. Fast forward to today, Canada is something like 7.5 percentage points ahead on female labor force participation. Why? Because they put in place increasingly progressive paid leave policies. If we had simply kept pace with Canada, over this period, we'd have 5.5 million more women in the workplace. 5.5 million more women contributing to our innovation economy, adding literally over $500 billion to our GDP.
There's another group of working people who actually need paid family leave support. The millions of Americans who provide care for their aging parents or spouses. We are in the midst of an unprecedented elder boom. Every 8 seconds, another baby boomer turns 65 in this country. By the year 2025, 1 in 5 Americans will be over the age of 65. We're rapidly aging, and at the same time, we have less people that are available to be able to care for people, especially aging adults over the age of 80, when they need more supports and services.
The reality is that we don't have enough health professionals to care for our aging population. So we will need to rely on family members and caregivers to resolve this growing need. If caregiving support is not available, seniors are likely to be placed in a nursing home or in an assisted living facility where the cost triples, if not more, to care for that person.
The national average cost of a semi-private nursing home is about $82,000 a year. what family in this day and age can afford $82,000 a year?
It's very important to stay in my own home because I have independence. So it keeps me much happier and it keeps me more that I can do some things for myself.
This is your vitamin B12. You take one of these a day? Mm-hmm. Okay.
It was a struggle trying to go to work plus take care of my mom. Paid leave would have helped me out a tremendous amount.
Fundamentally, the challenge that we're facing is that too many families are having to make options between continuing to work or to caregive. And there's not a family that can afford to not work, and there's not enough caregiving options that are really affordable and accessible for most families.
Okay, have a seat. Wonderful, wonderful.
This is the state capitol in Madison, Wisconsin, and we're here for a hearing before the Senate on the Wisconsin Family Insurance Act, which would create a family medical leave insurance fund.
So whenever we work with, you know, the women we work with, and they're thinking, oh my God, I can't get up and speak, and I'll tell them, we get to tell them, what you have is misinformation and lies, and what we have are the facts, and also the power of people's painful experiences that's going to change the world.
I didn't know if I was going to be able to make it through this conversation without tears coming, and I'm trying to fight them back now because my mom passed away. She suffered from many strokes before the massive heart attack took her. I'm here telling you that I wouldn't understand why I needed to choose, right? I didn't understand why I needed to be able to say either I go to work today or miss the very last chance to be able to see my mother on this side of glory. One thing that we all have common in this very same room right now, there's two sure things. One day we're going to be born and one day we're going to leave. Some people have the luxury of the high-paying jobs where they have the security of being able to say, well, we have this nest egg saved up so we don't have to worry. But what about those that don't? So I took a deep breath today and I told my mother, this is for you today. I'm sitting here on behalf of anyone else that's actually facing this right now today, whether or not they need to go to work or be able to sit by their husband's bedside, their child's bedside, you know, a significant other's bedside, without having the luxury of being able to say whether or not we're going to pay the bills or not. So take that into consideration when you're talking about passing this bill or not passing it, because it does affect so many lives, not just mine, but the others to follow. Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes the hearing.
We just saw something extraordinary today. There were people here, lobbyists, to indicate their opposition to the bill, but they did not stay to speak. Because what would they have said? What would they have said to Nancy Yarborough about her mother? What would they have said to Tamika Vukovich about losing her baby? What would they have said to Ronnie Crosby about being told by his employer, you didn't have that baby, so you don't get to take care of it when it's sick? They couldn't have answered that. That's the consequences on workers and their families when there isn't affordable leave. Bills for paid leave have been introduced in nearly two dozen states. That's clearly paving the way for a national bill so that everybody will be covered. The momentum is going to carry all over the country. We're going to see a growing movement.
There are problems almost impossible to comprehend fixing within our lifetime. Global terror, climate change, the growing island of garbage the size of India in the Pacific Ocean. But paid leave is something we can change now.
It's not a question of if, it's a question of when.
Okay, all right. Thank you. That was I really enjoyed that. I hope everyone else enjoyed it. It gives a good backdrop, and so we will be working on this as a committee as we move forward. So I'm going to close the informational meeting on paid family and medical leave, and we're going to open an informational meeting on the an update on pay equity. So on July 1st, 2017, Governor Brown signed into law House Bill 2005, also known as the Equal Pay Bill, expanding pay equity protections to Oregonians and creating new obligations for employers. The measure encouraged employers to complete periodic equal pay analysis in their workplaces and to eliminate any unlawful pay differentials those analysis revealed. In response to the new law, the Department of Administrative Services initiated the Pay Equity Analysis Project to bring Oregon state government's compensation and recruitment systems, policies, and practices into alignment. Today, we'll hear from the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries about the next steps in the implementation of the Pay Equity Bill, and we'll hear from the Department of Administrative Services about its Pay Equity Analysis Project. So I'm going to ask for Christine Lewis and Amy Clare to come up, please.
Chair Taylor, Vice Chair Knope, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Christine Lewis, and I'm joining you today just 1 week into my new position as Legislative Affairs Director at BOLI. The Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries really appreciates the opportunity to bring you an update on the implementation process for the 2017 HB 2005, the Equal Pay Law. As you know, part of this law went into effect this past fall on October 6th of 2017. Employers are now prohibited from seeking the pay history of an applicant or employee from the applicant or employee or a current or former employer of the applicant or employee before making an offer of employment that includes compensation. So BOLI's Technical Assistance Division has developed materials and training in order to assist employers. All employers are able to access a fact sheet on BOLI's webpage on the FAQ and fact sheet section. BOLI has submitted this fact sheet for your use, and for the record, it's in OLIS. BOLI has you will see that the fact sheet lays out provisions of the law and also details the permitted circumstances for an employer you will see that the fact sheet lays out provisions of the law and also details the permitted circumstances for paying employees performing work of comparable character at different levels. The technical assistance team is available to answer questions from employers who call or email BOLI. As a reminder, that team is extremely responsive to businesses. A performance measure of the unit is to return phone calls and return emails within 24 hours. However, staff generally are taking calls right as they're coming in. And additionally, the TA team is firewalled from our enforcement divisions. So the Bureau wants to underscore that they're a valuable resource for employers who are updating their hiring practices to comply with the new law. Our Technical Assistance Division has at their disposal the Oregon Council on Civil Rights formal recommendations and the best practice report that they reference often when working with employers. The TA team is also keeping a running list of frequently asked questions and areas of interest that will be passed on to the rulemaking process for clarification or inclusion. BOLI holds an annual conference for employers every November, and this past November, the technical assistance team was able to train approximately 150 employers on this new law. And in addition, the technical assistance team has conducted 20 seminars on new employment laws, and this equal pay law has been included. So that's over 200 additional employers who have been trained. The law requires BOLI to provide a template posting that meets the required notice provisions, and that will go into effect on January 1 of 2019. However, we are striving to publish that at July 1 of 2018, which is when the new composite poster will be published by BOLI. So we'll be putting that out 2018, even though it's not necessary until 19, just because that fits the composite poster schedule. The enforcement of this employer notice requirement and enactment of the other provisions of the Equal Pay Law do not begin until January of 2019, and BOLI will begin rulemaking in the coming months in order to establish rules for complaints and enforcement. We will work during early February to complete the roster of individuals and organizations who will participate in our rulemaking advisory committee. I expect rulemaking meetings in February, March, and April if needed, with a goal of making draft rules available for review by the end of April. Input from the advisory committee and the public will be an essential part of the rulemaking process. And I'm joined today by Amy Clare, who's the administrator of BOLI Civil Rights Division. She can share a bit more and answer technical questions. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify and share our progress on the 2017 Equal Pay Law.
Thank you, Christine.
Good afternoon, Senator, Chair, Taylor and Vice Chair Canope, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Amy Clare. I'm the administrator of the Civil Rights Division at Boley. I don't have a whole lot to add because the only part of this legislation that's in effect right now is a prohibition about inquiring about salary history and basing compensation on past history, although that's really huge. Even as an employer for the state of Oregon, until this legislation was passed, our hands were tied, and that's how we were having to bring people on, frankly. And it's always been a concern, so I'm really happy to see that. And there are a lot of terms in this legislation about comparable they don't call it comparable work, but work of comparable character. There's some other stuff that we're going to have to flesh out in the coming months, and we're going to work with industry and advocates to come up with some excellent rules, we hope. And we've got some time before a number of the other provisions go into effect in January of 2019. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I would like to add, though, however, that the current Chapter 659A of Oregon Revised Statutes currently does prohibit different treatment, and which includes pay differential based on the protected classes that are outlined in the chapter. So folks are not out of luck if they do feel they're being discriminated based on wage disparities. They can file with Boley now.
Okay, does anyone have any questions? I asked for an update on what's happened with the Equal Pay Bill because, if you remember, during the 2017 session, there were several timelines in it, and the first one went into effect in the fall. And so we just want to track it as we go forward because it is significant. So thank you both, and so unless there are questions. All right, thank you both for coming up. So now we'll call up Katie Koba and Madeline Zeich, please, from Department of Administrative Services. I saw Katie Koba here. She must have.
It's just me.
It's just you. Fantastic. Nice to see you.
Yes, nice to see you too. Good afternoon, Chair Taylor, members of the committee. For the record, I am Madeline Zeich, and I'm the State of Oregon's Chief Human Resources Officer. I'm actually really excited to provide this update today. We needed to comply with the new law, and we did remove the salary history field in October of 17, early in October. That was a really interesting event for us. I think you heard a little bit of it from Boley, but we realized how much we had relied on current salary in determining initial offers. And so at that time, we knew, because this was a big change, we needed to give our agencies another way to determine how much people should be making. So our team got together with stakeholders from agencies, and we came up with some tools that agencies are now using that actually look statewide and say, for this classification, here's who's being paid this in this agency and that agency and the next agency. So that's been really a good exercise for us in making sure that we're consistent moving forward. So that was really our first step. We have taken this on as a project.
Yes, Senator Madison.
Thank you. So when you were doing getting that data, salaries, is there a difference between rural and urban? I mean, I've been told that there is.
Chair Taylor, Senator Monis Anderson, we have started to find some of those differences. I think when we have more information on the training and experience of our applicant pool, when I talk about that in a minute, we'll be able to know if it's truly a regional difference or if it's really about our classification and approach. But I think you may recall when I was before you when we were talking about this bill, when we were looking at State of Oregon as an employer and where we were regarding equity, we were about at 89% equity, so we had some work to do. We know that's kind of our baseline, but it is something that we'll be definitely keeping an eye on as we're moving forward.
Okay,
keep going. So we determined that the best way to do this, and certainly with the timelines and wanting to make sure that it was effective, was to treat this as a project within DAS. So we've brought together stakeholders from our agencies, and we have a project manager, and we have a project team that's actually looking at the best way of doing this so that it isn't a DAS top-down type effort and that we have a lot of people that are involved in figuring out what we need to do in the way of the analysis. It also includes the governor's diversity an inclusion representative. So based on that, we determined, as we looked at kind of the universe of what we needed to analyze, that we were missing a couple pieces of key data, and that was training and education. We don't keep that in a system right now, although we're getting a brand new system in June, but we don't keep that right now. So as we were looking at things, we started seeing, well, what are the variables that we're missing? So we determined that we are going to survey, and the survey actually just opened yesterday, so it's exciting times at my office, 35,000 state employees, and start to review their training and experience so that we can get a full picture of what their background is, and it, so that everyone is doing work of a comparable character between our different classifications. Mm-hmm. So that survey just opened. We did not ask for any resources to do that. So as you can imagine, surveying 35,000 people is a big event. It's never been done in state government before. But we do have a lot of volunteers in the agencies that are helping us with that, and we'll work on the analysis. And then, as I mentioned, too, with our new Workday system, our new HR system coming up in June, that work won't be lost because we're working closely. That's under my auspices, too, and we're working closely to make sure that gets in there. So those are the two kind of key things that we have done so far. It is a big lift. I would, you know, somebody would say to me later, Madeline, why didn't you say it's a big lift? It is a big lift, and we are poised to ensure that we have the data analyzed by January of 19, as we're required to do. So that's pretty much our update for now. As I said, it's been a really interesting project, labor intensive, but I think we're going to get some really good information about how we move forward, not only with our existing workforce to make sure that we have equitable pay, but also to establish processes so that the new workforce, we won't have these problems again moving forward.
Okay. Unless there are any questions, that's all I
had to.
You've got a project ahead of you. How interesting. They're no longer asking how much people made in the past and all of those applications. I think it would be an interesting exercise. All right, any questions for Das? Well, we look forward to the updates as you go forward, and good luck in doing this. I'm sure you'll do a great job. So thank you, and we'll go ahead and we'll close the informational hearing on the
Thank you for having me
today. Yes. And now we're going to have another informational meeting, the implementation update on predictive schedules, another bill we passed in the last session. And we'll open up that meeting. And then, so on August 8th, 2017, Governor Brown signed into law Senate Bill 828, also known as the Predictive Scheduling Bill, requiring large retail, food service, and hospitality employers to provide good faith estimates of employees' work schedules, 7 days advance written notice of work schedules, predictability pay when schedules change, a right to rest between shifts, and extra compensation for hours worked when fewer than 10 hours separate shifts. Today we'll hear from the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries again and about next steps in the implementation of those legislative requirements. So, Christine Lewis, you're going to become very, well, I think we'll be seeing a lot of you in the future, it sounds like. And Gerard with the Administrator for the Boley Wage and Hour Division. So welcome, both of you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Excuse me, I am so sick, and so I apologize for my...
And as a nurse, you should not be here.
I have such warm feelings towards you too, Senator Vonna Sanderson.
We'll be quick. Chair Taylor, Vice Chair Knope, members of the committee, again, still Christine Lewis for the record, Legislative Director at Boley. The Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries appreciates the opportunity to briefly update you on the implementation of our 2017 Senate Bill 828, the Employee Work Scheduling Law. Boley has submitted the brand new Employee Work Scheduling posting. It's in OLIS, and I have some copies here today. The law requires Boley to update the template, to provide a template that meets the required notice provisions for covered employers effective July 1 of 2018. And so in the past week or so, this has been published. We've completed that part of our work. Boley's Technical Assistance Division has also been fielding questions from employers about who call or email Boley about this law. The list of frequently asked questions and issues will be passed on to a rulemaking advisory committee, and Boley will be pulling together the rulemaking advisory committee to draft rules in the coming weeks. And I'm joined today by Gerhard Teubel, who is the administrator of Boley's Wage and Hour Division, and he can share a little bit more about the division's work on employee work scheduling. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Taylor, members of the committee, my name is Gerhard Teubel. I'm the administrator of the Wage and Hour Division at Boley. I don't have much to add to Christine's summary. It was succinct, but I think thorough. I mean, this is where we are at this point. Senate Bill 828 takes effect on July 1st of 2018, and because of that deferred effective date, Boley had been concentrating on other types of rulemaking that took effect late last year or early this year. We're now ready to turn our attention to this bill. Specifically, in the next few weeks, we will be identifying issues within the bill that we think should be clarified in rules. We'll, as Christine mentioned, we'll also be convening a rules advisory committee. Well, I'm sure the members of that committee will come to us with suggestions as well of issues that they think might need to be clarified. In the meantime, even though the bill hasn't taken effect yet, we do receive questions from employers and sometimes also from employees about the meaning of the bill and how it will apply. And I think, at least from what I've seen thus far, probably the major area to consider will be just to whom this bill applies, what kind of employers, particularly employers who may have a business model which perhaps partly falls under the food services and hospitality and retail industries and partly doesn't, and how the rules will apply to those types of businesses. The goal is to have permanent rules in place well before the law takes effect so that both employers and employees will have time to familiarize themselves with its requirements and make any changes that they need to make to their scheduling practices in order to comply in the future. So I'm happy to answer any questions if I can, and that's my contribution today.
Okay, any questions? All right. Okay, well, thank you, and good luck with the rulemaking.
Thank you.
When does it officially start, the rulemaking?
The rulemaking, Senator Taylor, we'll probably convene the first rulemaking committee, I would guess, in March or early
March,
April.
Okay.
Yes.
And about how long will it take, do you think?
Just guessing, going on past experience, maybe 2-3 months to get through.
Just want to get a general sense. Okay.
Right. Hopefully well before July.
Yeah.
Complete well before July.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So we'll go ahead and close the informational meeting on the updated predictive schedules. And is there anything else anybody wanted to bring up? Because I think we're at the end here. So we're done an hour early, folks. How nice is that? So this concludes the meeting on the Senate Interim Workforce Committee, and we adjourn. And thank you.